Good morning, council ready to proceed.
May I please support and report to Senator Phyllis Romano on behalf of the petitioner and Michael Holter. Michael Holter respectfully requests this honorable court set aside the December 2003 amended order in March 2004, and to grant him a fresh hearing before the HTA. Mr. Holter is entitled to this relief because his in-laws were set in violation of his constitutional due process rights under both the 14th Amendment and the U.S. Constitution,
as well as Article 1, Section 5 of the Hawaii Constitution. Mr. Holter has a liberty interest in having an HPA minimum, which is determined pursuant to 706-669 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes, as well as the HPA's own guidelines. Furthermore, Mr. Holter is entitled to, but was not afforded, the procedures mandated by those two statutes and the statute and the guidelines. The reason that he has a liberty interest in having the HPA minimum determined pursuant to those to the statute and the guidelines is that when a state enacts a statute, there's an expectation that this statute will be followed. In 706-669 creates procedures for how a minimum term is determined, and the HPA basically is required to follow the terms of the statute in setting his minimum hearing. When they deviate or when they fail to follow it, then Mr. Holter, in this case, has been denied his due process rights to have the HPA follow the state statute. Now, 706-669, subsection 8, also requires the HPA to promulgate their own rules and guidelines for the determination of a minimum hearing, and they did so. They issued a document in 1989, which is still in use today, which basically sets out their own formula for how they're going to determine the length of a minimum term. So again, Mr. Holter has a liberty interest in having his HPA minimum determined by the specifics of the 1989 guideline. Both 706-669 as well as the guideline seek to ensure uniform and consistent determination of minimums, and that's a fairness issue. It seeks to kind of look at the broad range of inmates and say, based on significant factors like, say, your criminal history or the nature of the particular offense, etc., we're going to make you serve a certain amount of time, this certain amount of time, before you'll become eligible for parole. That's where the liberty interest comes in, because whatever minimum is set by the HPA actually determines when Mr. Holter can apply for parole, when he actually gets out. He cannot even apply to the HPA, I suppose they can always turn him down, before the end of the minimum. In this case, 7 years were set in both of his two counts. So it does affect his liberty interest because he's not entitled to a parole hearing or to parole consideration until he completes it. And he has a liberty interest also because no parole will be granted until he completes that minimum hearing.
Ms. Hironaka, do we even need to get to the question of due process if the statute already sets out requirements? And in fact, notice, hearing, reasons on the record for any deviation, the standards for the guidelines. I mean, assuming we follow the statute, or the statute sets out these requirements, which roughly equate to the rudiments of due process, do we even have to get to the issue of whether or not there's a liberty interest?
I would submit, or Mr. Holter submits, that the liberty interest is there, it's established. He does not quibble with the fact that 706-669 and the guidelines do give him due process rights. His problem was that they weren't followed. In his particular case, they were not followed.
So if they weren't followed, then the statute's been violated.
That's correct.
So in the case where a statute's been violated, the courts can remedy a violation of a statute, can't they?
Yes, they can.
And so the remedy can be imposed even without getting to the constitutional question?
Yes, they can.
So what would the remedy be?
The remedy would be a new hearing be ordered before the HPA with a requirement that they comply completely with the guidelines that they set out for themselves.
Well, the state says, you know, the minimum term hasn't been changed, so why a new hearing?
There were, in this case, two different orders issued. One was issued in March after an actual in-person hearing took place. The March 2003 hearing generally comported with due process, and we're not having a problem with the fact that he was...
Whether it comported with due process or not doesn't really matter, because the board is attempting to follow the statute, right? I mean, it was following the statute by holding a hearing.
It held a hearing, etc. What happened is that when the March board members issued their order, they did not follow their guidelines by saying what his level of punishment was and what the significant criteria were that they relied on in setting his minimums at that 7 years. And that's what precipitated Mr. Coulter filing a Rule 40 to get that relief. During the pendency of the Rule 40, he filed his Rule 40, his initial petition, I believe, in August of 2003. Several documents went back and forth. The state filed a response, he filed a response to that, et cetera. The briefing process, if you will, was not completed until December 29 of 2003, when Mr. Coulter filed his last document. 2 days after that was filed, the HPA sua sponte, now a completely different set of board members, none of whom were board members in the March, at the time of the March hearing, a completely different set of board members, sua sponte, sent Mr. Coulter a document purporting to be an amended order, amending this March 2003 order that set his minimums at 7 years. The order says, pursuant to following a hearing on March 11, 2003, that they reset his minimums at 7 years, and then they added on the level of punishment and the significant factors in compliance with the guidelines. The problem with that is that this board did not give him a hearing. Mr. Coulter didn't ask for his order to be amended, so amended, okay? It appeared, of course, to be a clear attempt to subvert the Rule 40 that was already in progress. And none of the due process rights were present. What the December board appeared to be doing is giving reasons for the March board's ruling. And that's the problem, because the December board, none of those members were present. They didn't hear any of the evidence or arguments that were set forth at the March hearing. They didn't participate in the discussions that the March board members held before setting the minimum. So they could not possibly intuit the reasons that the March board set his minimums at 7 years.
Well, you referred to the board and they. Is there any evidence in the record that the board actually together, all its members, met and came up with this order?
The March board or the December board?
December board.
There is no evidence. There was no evidence. That was the problem at the Rule 40 hearing, is that although they submitted the tape of the March hearing into evidence, there was no evidence presented that the December board members listened to the tape or even understood, you know, if the there were discussions about what the reasons were that the minimums were set at 7 years.
I'm sorry, did they all sign off on the order?
On the December order?
Yes.
Just the chair signed off on it. So there was no evidence that there was any meeting between the three December board members to discuss.
Does the order recite that they met?
No, it does not. It's a very perfunctory order. It's Exhibit C, I believe, attached to the opening brief, but it's dated December 31, 2003. It's signed only by the chair of the Hawaii Proling Authority, as well as Tommy Johnson, who was the then administrator of the HPA. But the one of the critical things, I think, is that it says, following a hearing held on March 11, 2003. Now, this is signed by a chairperson who was not even present, wasn't even on the board in March of 2003. So it's very difficult to see how that person could be saying, following the hearing on March 2003, we find that your reasons for the setting of your minimum at 7 should be X or Y. The liberty interests, I'd like to establish that there was a liberty interest created both by 706669 as well as by the guidelines, which was the framework that the board established for the determination of a minimum. And basically, the board has promulgated this grid that goes according to what your maximum indeterminate sentence is, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, life, etc. Mr. Coulter was sentenced to 2 indeterminate 10-year terms, B felonies. And so he would be looking at the second line that says 10 years. The board has divided up categories of offenders into level 1, 2, and 3 offenders. Level 1, of course, being the least serious. Level 3 being ones with, say, a big criminal history or had committed a very heinous crime. Circumstances were very heinous. For each of these levels, the board has set itself a range within which a standard minimum term should be placed. For a 10-year offense, a level 3 has a range between 5 and 10 years where an inmate should be serving or should expect to serve a minimum between 5 to 10 years. So he can be maxed out as in the Williamson case. Once the board determines what kind of an offender you are, then they should look at the range. So for example, if they decided Mr. Coulter were a level 1 or a level 2, they would be looking at 1.5 to 3 or 3 to 5 years in determining the standard range. The board does have the discretion under its own rules to deviate from the guidelines. However, the guidelines itself give the inmate due process by saying any deviations have to be accompanied by a written justification as to why you're going above or below the standard range, and that written justification has to be made a part of the order. That was not done in Mr. Coulter's case. Now referring to the March board, was he not told what level he was so that he could figure out what his standard range would be? But they didn't say whether his 7 years were a deviation or whether that was within the standard range. What appears to have happened is when the December board amended the March order, they looked at it and they said, well, for somebody who's got a 10-year offense, 7 years can only be found in the standard range of a level 3 offender. So we're going to classify Mr. Coulter as a level 3 offender, and then we don't need to give a reason because there is no deviation. He's within the standard range. We would submit that as to the March board, Mr. Coulter's liberty interest in the guidelines was not followed because they didn't basically set forth how it was that they came upon their determination that he should get a 7-year minimum. Hawaii case law, there are two important cases. The Williamson case, which is this court's case, first confirms that 706669 gives all the due process procedures there are in the setting of a minimum term. It states that, or it holds that, that 706669 gives prisoners the due process protections to which they are entitled, and it also ensures that the HPA does not arbitrarily set minimums. Turner versus Hawaii Paroling Authority, which is an ICA decision, authorized judicial review of parole denials, which were arbitrarily and capriciously done. And then Williamson came, which came a year later, extended the avenue of judicial review to HPA minimums, which are arbitrarily and capriciously imposed in violation of a defendant's due process rights. And this is where Mr. Coulter hangs his hat in regard to case law within Hawaii, that he does have, this court has the authority to remedy arbitrary and capricious impositions of minimum terms. And that was where he argued that in his case, they were arbitrarily and capriciously imposed.
So, excuse me.
Yes.
So would you lay out how this liberty interest justifies your position? Assuming there's a liberty interest in minimum term proceedings, because that implies that at some point parole may be granted, and parole would obviously result in liberty.
Correct.
So how does that affect the facts of this case?
Wolf versus, I think it's McDonald. I've just been going by first names. Wolf versus McDonald is the case that in 1974 found that a state can create a liberty interest by the statutes or by administrative rules that it promulgates and purports to follow. So in Wolf, the Nebraska inmates were entitled to, under state statute, a reduction in the maximum time that they had to serve by accrual of good time credits. These were, incorporated in state statute, and it was basically automatic that the inmates received a reduction in the maximum term. The only way that good time credits could be taken away from an inmate were if they did some kind of a misconduct, and it had to be a serious misconduct. And so a misconduct happened, the board or the prison authority sought to take away the inmate's good time credits, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that the Nebraska's implementation of a statute which created this expectation of liberty did give the inmates a liberty interest which could not be removed arbitrarily. It had to be removed or taken away with following due process procedures. So based upon that, Mr. Coulter submits that since the state of Hawaii enacted 706669, which gives due process procedures in the creation of a minimum term or the setting of a minimum term, and then pursuant to 669, also the promulgation of the 1989 guidelines, which gives sort of further fleshing out to how a minimum term is to be determined, that he does have a valid liberty interest. And also, as stated earlier, since the board will not even consider an inmate for parole until he completes his minimum, and will not give him a parole hearing until he completes his minimum, then clearly Mr. Coulter had a liberty interest in the way that his 7 years was determined. The converse might be more easy to see, which is that if Mr. Coulter had no liberty interest at all, then the HPA can kind of willy-nilly, helter-skelter, arbitrarily and capriciously set your minimum, and the inmate would have no right to complain.
Well, that's a situation where you would need to show a liberty interest, right?
Well, I'm not sure I'm following the question there.
In order to justify imposition of due process requirements like notice, hearing, the right to confront the evidence.
Well, looking at the March board's result, where it said you're given 7 years, and there was no explanation, no level of punishment, or the significant criteria upon which that decision was based, it does appear to be an arbitrary and capricious decision, because there basically is no sort of grounding that he can look to say, I understand why I got my 7 years, because they found me to be a level 3 offender, or they deviated from whatever level they found me to be. And so, even though they granted him the procedures of having the hearing, et cetera, it appears that they just picked a number out of the air and said, this is what you have to serve. With regard to the December board's order, although they purported to justify it with the level 3 determination, et cetera, that was definitely arbitrarily capriciously imposed because they did not grant him an in-person hearing. He had no right to allocute. These were completely different people who may have different thinking or different views about how or why a particular minimum should be given. And he was not entitled to any chance, opportunity to explain to the then board members, you know, the facts of his case, or to even, for example, you know, express remorse for what happened, the things that the board members look at very closely in determining on the minimum.
Did you make an equal protection argument?
Originally, I made an equal protection argument because Mr.
In your opening brief?
In my opening brief, yes, because it appeared that although we didn't have evidence of what was going on with other inmates, it was only Mr. Coulter's case that he was filing that Rule 40 on. It appeared that he may have been a part of a class of inmates that did not get the due process protections of having the level of punishment and the significant criteria listed on their on their orders. Apparently, since Mr. Coulter had filed his Rule 40 hearing, the present board, or since December of 2003 board, has been including the level of punishment and the significant criteria. So that is good that they are following through with their own procedures. However, for the inmates that were in Mr. Coulter's position who had their minimums determined prior, it's still obviously problematic. Mr. Coulter would like to point the court's attention to the case of Inri Sinca and Roe, which is a Washington State Supreme Court case, which it involves, of course, minimum term hearings on grounds pretty much similar to Mr. Coulter. And I see I'd asked for 10 minutes of rebuttal, which I forgot to ask this honorable court. My apologies. But I'd like to finish this last point, which is that the Sinca case, the Washington statutes were very similar to the Hawaii statutes and admin rules in Mr. Coulter's case, which is that they were indeterminate terms set, that there were minimums that the paroling authority was to set, and they had not only a Washington statute that said how a minimum is determined, but they also had a set of administrative regulations in how the sort of the details of how a minimum is to be set. The Washington Supreme Court found that a liberty interest was created by the statutes and regulations along the lines of Wolf, and they listed a number of reasons that make sense under Mr. Coulter's facts, which is that prisoners may justifiably rely on a parole board's following its guidelines when setting minimum terms, that the board created these guidelines and also created the expectation that they would be followed. They recognized that when the expectation was disappointed by a deviation from the from the standard range, that written reasons must be given, and that the adoption of these guidelines established an explicit decision-making policy that would ensure that similar persons would be dealt with in similar ways in similar situations. So in other words, defendants with similar criminal records who had committed a similar crime could reasonably expect that they had would get a similar.
Is In Re Sinca still good law in Washington?
To my understanding, it's still good law. In conclusion, Mr. Coulter does respectfully reiterate that he asks this board to set aside both the December 2003 and March 2003 orders and to grant him a fresh minimum term hearing before the Hawaii Paroling Authority, and that would provide the necessary compliance with due process under both the U.S. and the Hawaii State Constitution. Thank you.
May it please the court, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Lisa Emmy Tamura on behalf of Respondent Appellee State of Hawaii. Your Honor, Justice Levinson, I'd like to follow up on your question on whether or not Inri Sinca is still good law. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, Washington State Supreme Court has issued some contradictory cases following Inri Sinca. The court has also issued a case by the name of Inri Ayers, A-Y-E-R-S, 105 Washington 2nd, 161, 713 Pacific 2nd, 1986, that stated that inmates do not have a protected liberty interest in parole release at the expiration of the board set minimum terms, and that the procedures used for what they call parolability hearings are constitutionally adequate when followed. They distinguished Mana Sinka as concerning statutory requirements where the original minimum term was set, and they discussed in that case, well, Inri Sinka involved cases where the inmates were alleging that the board was basing its decision on misleading or erroneous information, so they asked, that's why they imposed the requirement that the parole board inform the inmates of any adverse information in its file, or at least offer the inmate the access to his file so that he could denote any erroneous or inaccurate information that he could flag for the board.
Are you familiar with Labrum v. Utah State Board of Pardons, the 1993 decision?
Yes, Your Honor, I did also look at that. That is one of the few, that Labrum, and I do believe there is a West Virginia case, Tasker, T-A-S-K-E-R versus Mon, M-O-H-N, that also cites Inri Sinka in support of a situation where the court found liberty interest, limited liberty interest in the parole board setting of a minimum term. I note that those are the only two cases that I could find that cited Inri Sinka outside of Washington State. I do believe Washington State has since changed its sentencing scheme, as Your Honor noted in State versus Rivera. They've gone to a very somewhat complicated scheme that has been reviewed by the United States Supreme Court in Blakey versus Washington and other cases. But
well, what's your position with respect to the Labrum proposition that an original release hearing conducted by the paroling authority is analogous to sentencing hearings?
I would have to respectfully disagree with the Utah State's, Supreme Court's, analysis of the minimum term hearing, which also, again, depends on Inri Sinka. I guess their feeling was that somehow, because the sentencing judges, in Inri Sinka, the Washington State Court noted that the sentencing judge had, a procedure whereby they issued recommendations or to the board that the parole board was also supposed to take into consideration when setting the minimum term. And so they sort of culled all that together and sort of magnified made the sentencing similar to the minimum term setting. I think in the Hawaii system where the parole board is totally separate from the sentencing court, there is no recommendations issued by the sentencing court. The only connection really between the sentencing court and the parole board is a judgment ad minimis, which is issued, and basically the pre-sentence report done, prepared by the adult probation.
Well, I'm not sure which way that cuts. Hawaii has an indeterminate sentencing scheme, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
In other words, with respect to a Class B felony, the sentencing court doesn't have the discretion to set the maximum term at some point between 5 years and 10 years.
That's correct.
If the court had, which would then transform our system into a determinate scheme, wouldn't it?
That's correct.
If the court had that discretion, the defendant would certainly have a liberty interest in the sentencing court's exercise of discretion as to where between 5 and 10 years his maximum was going to be, would he not?
I can't, Your Honor, I guess I'm trying to, it's hard for me to understand. I guess I don't see a liberty interest.
In our system, assuming the offense is probationable, but the sentencing court opts for a prison term, And everything else being equal, the court has no alternative but to impose an open 10 years for a Class B felony conviction.
That is correct.
Intrinsic in our system is that it's the court's function to set the maximum. It's the paroling authority's function to set the minimum. Whereas in a determinate system, the sentencing court has some, there's some play with respect to what the maximum is. I mean, a fortiori, doesn't that render the original release hearing or minimum term hearing all the more analogous to a sentencing proceeding?
I guess I would have to respectfully disagree, I guess, Your Honor. I don't see, in Meacham versus Fano, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that a valid conviction basically extinguishes any liberty interest the defendant had. Once that conviction is entered by the criminal court, he is, you know, constitutionally deprived of his liberty, and that's that. And in Greenholz, they continued on with that analysis by saying, you know, in Greenholz, the inmates were granted, or actually in Greenholz, denied parole. They were claiming they had a liberty interest in the procedures and parole and release from custody before the expiration of their sentence. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, there is no such liberty interest. There is no inherent right under the Due Process Clause to release from custody before the expiration of a valid sentence.
Doesn't arguably the legislative creation of an early release system called parole generate at least an expectation of the possibility of early release, or the opportunity for early release?
Well, certainly the opportunity. However, as in Greenholz, again, the court said the opportunity is not necessarily the right to, and they distinguish between, in fact, that's one of the problems.
Well, at least there's a right to an opportunity, isn't there?
No, not necessarily. I mean, in the defendant's supplemental brief, they hang their hat on Morrissey, where they're talking about revocation of parole, and the U.S. Supreme Court in Greenholz specifically said, no, the analysis in Morrissey concerning revocation of parole cannot apply to a situation where parole is denied, release from custody is denied before the expiration of a valid sentence. And the court in Greenholz specifically said there's a difference between losing a benefit that one has. I do believe they're quoting Judge Henry Friend, I think. There's a difference between losing a benefit that one has and not getting a benefit you want. There's a difference between losing your release from custody, you're getting your parole revoked, and not getting released from custody.
But in Green, I'm sorry.
It's granting that, I mean, accepting that is true. Does the fact that there are differences establish conclusively that one doesn't have an interest in obtaining the earliest possible release?
Differences between between indeterminate and determinate sentencing, or differences between release dates?
Difference between relinquishing a right that you have, and, you know, the distinction that you were just drawing.
No, you know, I think the court was very clear in that case that, you know, mere speculation, the hope that one will get released from custody earlier than 10 years from now, is that all that is, a mere hope. It is not.
That's what the statute and the guidelines in our case, I mean, in our jurisdiction, establish, a mere hope.
Well, they establish procedures that a person may be released from custody before the expiration of that sentence.
Why bother with procedures?
The legislature and the Hawaii Paroling Authority has established these procedures to try and make the process as uniform as possible for all inmates.
As fair as possible.
That is the, I guess, the procedures to be followed, yes.
Ms. Tamura, in Greenholz, Didn't the court say that a statute can give rise to an expectancy of release?
And that is correct, Your Honor, and that's where they drop down into the analysis of state statutes, where they go into the...
Which is entitled to some measure of constitutional protection.
That is correct, Your Honor. They go into the what is called the mandatory language analysis.
So Greenhold says you can, we are in a state of federalism. Every state can be different. States can say no parole, or the states can say parole. And if they say parole, then there's some expectancy of release that may give rise under the statutory language.
That's partially true in that the mere setting up of a parole system in and of itself is not enough, according to Greenholz and subsequent case law, to give rise to a liberty interest. In Nebraska, the Nebraska statute that Greenholz was looking at, they discussed very, very carefully that the statute said, you shall release unless other factors are found. I think in case law over the nation, the courts have said, different circuit courts have said, statutes have to use those mandatory prerequisites, they call them, shall, will.
Well, which is what is in our statute, right?
That is correct, but then you also drop down to the fact that what is being mandated, is there a particular result being mandated? In Greenholz, basically the court found that the statute mandated parole unless other factors were found.
Well, is due process at least mandated?
In
669, 670, the guidelines.
Well, due process in and of itself is not mandated. I think, as Your Honor has seen, you have to start off with a due process analysis, is whether or not there's a liberty interest involved. And I think that's where Mr. Coulter's argument falls apart, because...
So it's your position that a convicted defendant who is sentenced to an indeterminate maximum term of imprisonment has no due process rights with respect to the parole process.
He has no liberty interest in the procedures to be
and
used.
And therefore, due process doesn't even compute.
Well, liberty interest is not one of the interests that is involved, no, the constitutional rights.
So the answer to my question, I take it, is no. A defendant has no due process rights with respect to the parole system.
No, no liberty interest in the release from custody before the expiration of a valid sentence, yes. I mean, I think that's where, again, where Mr. Coulter's argument falls apart, is that he's elevating what is admittedly a mistake by the March board, where they failed to put certain information on his order. He's elevating that and trying to bootstrap into a constitutional violation and saying, well, I need a new hearing. The correction in and of itself is not enough. I need a new hearing. I need a new bite at the apple. I need a new shot at getting my minimum lowered. And that really is what he's looking for. It's not the information on his order, really, he doesn't care. I mean, the board tried to correct the omission, and he still challenges the board's correction. I mean, I think the case of State versus Monolim, even if assuming that there is some kind of argument that Mr. Coulter has a due process interest in the procedures to be used, he still has to come in and say, this mistake, this omission from my March 03 order caused me some kind of prejudice, actual prejudice that somehow hurt me. And I think that, again, that's where his argument falls apart. There is no prejudice. He concedes that he got his due process at his March 2003 hearing, and it's only the paperwork afterwards that he complains about. And now he just wants another shot at a new board, and hopefully this board will give him a lower minimum than the March board.
About the argument that the first board didn't give its reasons, didn't follow its own rules? The second, we assume, board or someone enters an order with those with reasons, but never had a hearing, and so really had no basis either from the March order or in the present December situation, on which to base its determination that Coulter fell within the level three category?
Well, I think the testimony at the August 2004 hearing on the Mr. Coulter's petition, Mr. Tommy Johnson testified that the, I guess what you call the December 2003 board reviewed Mr. Coulter's case before issuing the December 03 order with the omitted items on it. That's the correction that was made. Obviously, there was no new findings made. There was no resetting. Mr. Coulter keeps saying resetting, but his minimum was not reset. There was no change in his programming either. It was merely putting or correcting the omission of the information that was left off. I think, again, Mr. Coulter cannot point to any sort of, outside of a due process violation, any other reason why the mere failure to put the level of punishment and significant criteria on his order somehow translates into the need for a new hearing. And I think that is, in effect, a red herring of sorts. Yes, there was a new board in December of 03, but given that it was a correction of a omitted information, not necessarily a new evidentiary hearing, there was no need for notice, Mr. Coulter to be present, his counsel to be present, and so forth. Just to clarify, I guess, again, Mr. Coulter does not challenge the procedures used at his March 2003 minimum term hearing. The only complaint he has is about the paperwork afterwards, leaving off.
It's not merely paperwork, though, right? That so-called paperwork is at least one basis by which Mr. Coulter can determine the reasons for his sentence and either address them or try to refute them, right?
That is correct, Your Honor, and that's why the board took it upon itself.
And the statute says that the board is supposed to follow these guidelines, and it says the guidelines shall be public records and should be made available to the prisoner and other interested government agencies, so that presumably these requirements that the board itself set out should be followed, right?
That is correct, Your Honor, and that's why the December board went back and tried to correct
The December board hear anew the evidence or review the evidence submitted before the March board?
The testimony of Mr. Johnson is that the board reviewed the case. Unfortunately, although Mr. Coulter certainly had the opportunity to, no one else was subpoenaed to testify at that hearing, and so all we have is Mr. Johnson's testimony and the audio tape of the March.
Something in the brief says that the witness said, I think, I don't recall, so that his testimony was not definite. Is that accurate?
No, I believe if you look at the transcript at page, at the top of page 8, he was not clear about certain things. That is true. Unfortunately, he was being asked questions about what the members of the board had done, not what he himself had done. But he was clear that the board had reviewed the case and issued the corrected order. So whether or not that constitutes that in and of itself, just reviewing the case constitutes a new evidentiary hearing whereby Mr. Coulter must be present and notice must be given and so forth. That is where, that jump is where the respondent appellee must respect.
Is the March order invalid? Was the March order invalid?
I would say not, Your Honor. I mean, it sets a minimum term, it sets the programming, it sets a projected, what they call tentative expiration date for the minimum term. The only information that's not on that order, again, is the level of punishment and the significant criteria. That's all. And that's all the information that's put on in the December 2003 order. That's all. And again, the board tried to correct the omission, the board is still getting criticized for trying to correct the omission, and, but the board is trying to, again, comply with the procedures and its guidelines. It is not, this is not a case where the board is trying to somehow, is refusing to do anything. The board is trying to comply with its own guidelines, and unfortunately, even in the compliance, we're still, the board is still getting
only after
challenged.
A petition and a lawsuit was filed.
Well, not a lawsuit, but a petition. Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. Unfortunately,
a petition is a lawsuit.
Unfortunately, I don't think, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not clear on this, but I'm not, I don't think Mr. Coulter informed the parole board of the problem before filing the Rule 40 petition. So unfortunately, that was the only way the board knew that something had happened or that there was a problem with the order.
Did the board, the new board, review any material that was not before the March board?
There is no evidence. Again, unfortunately, all we have is Mr. Johnson's testimony that the board reviewed his case. There's no specification as to what materials they reviewed. Again, the respondents, because it was a merely adding omitted items from onto the March 03 order, there was no need for a new evidentiary hearing and therefore new consideration of any evidence. In summary, Your Honor, I think, again, as I pointed out earlier, the problem with Mr. Coulter's argument is that he's bootstrapping an admitted omission from his March 2003 order into a constitutional violation that justifies a new, brand new hearing and another bite at the apple. Again, the board corrected the omission. There was no, there's no evidence, I might add as well, that the board considered any information not at the March 2003 hearing. There's no evidence that the board considered anything other than what the March 2003 board had before it.
I take it, given Mr. Thompson's testimonies, there's no evidence as to what the new board considered, period. Isn't that so? They can, he testified that the new board considered Mr. Coulter's case.
They reviewed his case,
reviewed
yes.
his case. But I take it no clarification or elaboration as to what factually the new board reviewed?
No, Your Honor, that was the end of Mr. Johnson's testimony. Your Honor, if there's no further questions, that is all for the respondent. I have 5 minutes, I think, left.
In brief response to some of the state's points and some of the questions asked by the court, in looking at my reply brief, Mr. Coulter's reply brief, the only there was no evidence that the 12-31-03 HPA board reviewed anything having to do with Mr. Coulter's case. Mr. Johnson's testimony taken from the state's answering brief was, I think it was at the request of Mr. Coulter at a, and I'm not sure, Lisa could probably give you more information. I'm not sure if he's referring to Ms. Itamura, a different person. It says, but I think Mr. Coulter had notified the HPA that the level and significant criteria used were not placed on his minimum sentence, and therefore the parole board at that time went through and looked and reviewed the case and added those other things in. Mr. Coulter did not contact the HPA. He just filed his Rule 40 in August of 2003. So Mr. Johnson's testimony only says that what he thinks the HPA, the December HPA, did. It does not, he did not state specifically what the December HPA considered or looked at prior to issuing their December 31 order or amended order. With regard to the actual prejudice, basically by failing to put any level of punishment or failing to put the significant criteria on the March order, Mr. Coulter had a very difficult time in his Rule 40 proceedings because he had no substantive basis. He had no words that he could point to challenge the imposition of his 7-year minimums. He had a very difficult time saying why it was unfair, other than the fact that he basically didn't know. Harking back to the state's question, the question that the court asked the state about why bother with procedures and fairness, basically, if Mr. Coulter has no idea why a particular number was picked for him, it's the equivalent to having a 10-sided dice being thrown on the table, and whatever number comes up, that's the number that he gets. It doesn't make any sense to him, and he's only asking that the board just follow its own procedures in making explicit for him why they picked that minimum. And then returning back to the issue of the liberty interest, again, that was asked of the state, Mr. Coulter cannot ask for parole consideration until he completes his minimum. He cannot get a parole hearing, and he certainly can't be released from custody. So does the board's giving of a minimum affect his liberty interest? Absolutely it does, because he has to serve out that time before the board will even countenance a request for him from parole. And that's very different from the issue of whether he has a right to release from parole. He's not saying that he has a right to release on parole, as in Greenholds, et cetera. He is saying that he has a right to have his minimum determined so that at some later point down the line, he can seek the parole and he can understand why.
What about the change in the Washington Supreme Court decision? How does that affect your position?
I believe that Washington, at the time that the Cinca decision was on a system similar to ours, that's kind of now with Blakely, etc. That's all been challenged. How that affects the issue of whether Mr. Coulter's how it affects his minimum. I'm not sure, frankly, what the Washington, sentencing scheme is like at this point. But they were under, at the time, they were under a scheme similar to what we've got now, which is the business about a determinate sentencing of 5, 10, or 20. In fact, it was very similar to what Hawaii has. Now, and that the parole board would set what that minimum was before the inmate is eligible for parole. And so we would submit that since Mr. Coulter had basically, he has a liberty interest in whatever the HPA decides, because he cannot, although he has no right to parole, he cannot go out on parole prior to the expiration of his sentence. So that liberty interest in the procedures that grant him or establish for what his minimum is become very critical to the inmate, because that is what he or she is shooting for in making his arguments to the board at the point in time when he becomes eligible that he's done what the board has asked him to do. With that, Your Honor, we would conclude that this board should vacate the two orders, the December order as well as the March order, and just allow Mr. Coulter a new hearing before the currently comprised HPA, who can see and hear his side as well as the state side. It's similar in regard to being able to the evidence should not have changed. For example, what the family may say or what Mr. Coulter may say about how he feels, there should be very little change in the facts, and it's asking only for a very brief amount of the board's time to basically give Mr. Coulter the knowledge as to why he's serving what he's serving. Thank you.
Court will take this matter under advisement.